Research assistants, as Senator Flacco pointed out, frequently will have their stipend, and in some cases, their tuition paid on a grant or contract. You know, so part of the 130-odd million in research expenditure that NDSU has this year are funds which are provided to us by NIH, NASA, NSF to pay for student stipends, graduate research student stipends. A graduate research assistant, other than their responsibility to take their courses and to make progress towards their degree, their primary responsibility is to engage in research. So we're looking at maybe 20 or 30 or perhaps even 40 hours of research per GRA per week. And I think you can do the math. If you just parametrically say we have 2,000 graduate students each doing 20 hours of work a week, there's 2 million man hours of research that particular group is performing. I should also point out that the teaching assistants also do research, but not their progress towards degree is not as quick because they also have teaching responsibilities. There's a government circular called OMB 821 that gives some guidance to research universities on how we treat tuition and waivers across groups of students. And essentially, it requires us to treat all students in a particular group in the same fashion. So the idea of simply paying students more with their stipend so that we wouldn't have to waive their tuition is in fact a way we could proceed. It has a downside to it. And the downside is that means that when we're writing grants and contracts that we're pursuing competitively, not all grants and contracts are funded. The faculty and other institutions would rather that they're funded than ours. So when we're pursuing these grants and contracts, we could ask for more money for a stipend, but the accounting practices are that when we request stipend, we also have to add to it what's called F&A or overhead. And so an overhead rate is a set rate that's computed every several years with the federal agencies. It typically will be around something 43-50%. So there's an extra cost to undertaking research if you use the model of just increasing the stipend and then charging the student the tuition and having them pay the tuition to us. The tuition on a grant or contract does not carry F&A. So I present that as one of about 100 things that have yet to come up in discussion that help confine, you know, how we do things. I hope it doesn't get in the way of you understanding that there are specific objectives that both NDSU and UND have, and we are using Policy 820 and reporting our data in accord with 820 in pursuit of the objectives I've just laid out here for you. I'll try not to duplicate other things. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for your time. I'll open the floor to any questions you might have.
Questions? You're not leaving, right?
I would. No, I'll be here. And so I've been involved in this type of activity for my entire career. And if you've been saving up a particularly hard question, now's probably the time to.
I would like to let UND give their presentation.
Okay.
And if I do have a couple of questions I'd like to ask, but I'd like to get UND's presentation first. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just say thank you for telling us that if we have hard questions, we can ask you. If you have yes or no answers, we will.
You know, most of the time in a committee meeting, they get a little slower as the meeting progresses. Today, they're getting a little feisty. UND.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Kelly. I'm the president of the University of North Dakota. And with me this afternoon is our vice president for finance and operations, Alice Brecky. I believe in the interest of time, since you have heard virtually everything that I had prepared to say, And I have to say this, it took UND less time to beat NDSU in basketball than the current testimony of my colleague here. I couldn't resist that, Bruce, I'm sorry. Literally everything that I had prepared to say, Provost Rayford has covered, and this was in direct response, Representative Dash, to your question, which was a good one. Why do we do this? And you just heard an excellent demonstration of why we do. Let me just give you a couple of quick anecdotes, and then in the interest of time, try to respond to questions with some of Alice's quantitative information. The reason that we do this is represented by one of our students from Mohall, North Dakota. He was a graduate of Minot State in music education. His name is Vincent Generale. We gave Vincent an assistantship. It included a stipend and it included a tuition waiver. And Vincent is now working on a doctorate in education. He's teaching two courses for the university. One is Introduction to Education, the other is Classroom Management. He's working on a dissertation in the western part of North Dakota, researching how the oil boom has impacted schools and communities in that area. So this is one student that we competed for, North Dakota student, permitted that student to go with a little financial package, and we hope to get a great deal out of Vincent. Another student is an international student, Vishnu Reddy. Vishnu is an astronomer, space studies. We were competing with MIT for him, and we were able to attract Vishnu. He was receipt of, an assistantship, research assistantship. It had a tuition waiver associated with it. Vincent recently discovered an asteroid, which he was permitted to name, which he named North Dakota. So there's another reason why we are very proud of what it is that we do with our financial resources. So with that, just a couple of anecdotes, trying to explain a little bit on a human level of what it is that we do. Let me direct your attention, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, to Alice, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the metrics, and then respond to your questions.
Representative Scarfo, members of the committee, there has been a lot of data presented today. I'm not going to walk back through all of that. As I was listening to the various questions and the conversations, I identified a couple of points that I'd like to provide a UND perspective on, a little bit of background information. Let me start with an approach that we as an institution have taken for a number of years. To the extent that through board policy we have an opportunity to come forward in a particular program area or for a particular new initiative for a specific special rate of tuition, we have made the conscious choice to do that to the degree we are able. So for example, occupational therapy is a program that has a differential rate. You'll see those noted in one of the tables that Karin provided to you. So rather than, from a residency standpoint, seeing that 267%, there was some rationale put together, presented to the board, and the board approved alternative rates. In addition to that, to the extent that we are dealing with entities that enable particular groups of students to access our programs, I would use our clinical lab science program and a relationship that they had with the Mayo Clinic as an example. I would also use our aerospace program and some of the contract relationships that they have, sometimes with foreign countries or foreign airlines, sometimes with US-based companies. In those situations, there is a section of board policy that allows us to negotiate, in essence, a package deal for the students that will come to us under that program. The requirement is that the rate charged not be less than the resident rate. It certainly can be more, but when those students come and they're enrolled and that third party is providing the tuition either in whole or in part for those students, we do not record that as a waiver. It is set up in the system as a special rate of tuition that's tied to that particular agreement billed in whole or in part to a third party. The third party pays. With some of those agreements, there are also other dimensions to the contractual arrangement. So we may be foregoing tuition from the perspective of the standard rates that are the frame of reference. There may be equipment that the company is providing that is then used in that program. There may be other financial dimensions to the relationship that are helping to cover the costs that we incur as an institution that is not reflected in the tuition collected. So in response to Representative Heilman's question regarding when Mr. Thursby is trying to come up with that per credit amount, there may be dollars that are outside of the tuition collected that actually are supporting the fact that those credits are being taken. And depends on what time period you're looking at, but that's an item that I thought it would be important to mention.
Do you have a dollar value to equate to that? I mean, in your negotiation process, is there a dollar value given to that so that it could be reflected, if so desired, as tuition waiver for purposes of being fair? And I use a fair rather liberally here.
And what we would want to do is go back to those specific agreements and identify what that dollar amount is. It would be identified.
How many students do you think are involved?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. Again, these types of agreements occur in a couple of different areas of the institution. So we'd want to look at what time period do we want to take the snapshot? Is it fiscal year 11, fiscal year 10? And then just pull the rest of the data, which we should be able to do.
And I think in the interest of fairness, it might be a good idea to provide that.
We certainly can.
With some detail as to where. I mean, if it's in aeronautics or if it's, you know.
Yes. Yep, we'll get that information put together. Another item that I did want to comment on gets to how we manage our graduate assistantships. Teaching research service. If you go back probably 15 years, because there was a bit of a conflict at the federal level between federal costing policy and Internal Revenue Code interpretation, higher education institutions got kind of pushed into the position of needing, if they were paying a stipend and wanted to do the waiver scenario, it became a package deal. You paid the stipend, the waiver became automatic. And it got into, and I'm not going to rehash the whole thing, but is the person an employee? Are they a student? Or are they both? And was the Internal Revenue Code in conflict with the federal costing principles? During that period of time, federal grants and contracts were not allowing tuition to be charged against the federal grants and contracts. Some institutions continued to try to do that, but it was at risk of cost disallowance depending on which region of the country you were in. North Dakota took a very conservative approach and said, if you have an assistantship with a stipend, the waiver was automatic. In 2001, there was clarification issued on that particular point. So that enabled institutions to explore a little bit more assertive cost recovery, if you will. So what we chose to do, and it took us a couple of years to work through this, we disconnected stipend and waiver for all categories, for teaching, for research, and for service. We also, to the extent that we were able in the federal grant and contract application process, if we were applying for the stipend, we also tried to apply for the reimbursement of the student's tuition so we wouldn't have to waive it. If the grant was awarded, we could charge that to the grant and thereby recover those dollars. We've been somewhat successful in that regard, But the other thing that it forced us to do was really look carefully at, to what degree do we want to waive the graduate tuition? And working with the graduate school, we put in place a process where the graduate students that have waivers are only eligible up to the number of credits in their approved program of study. If they want to take more credits than that, they can pay for that themselves. That's certainly their choice. But we also were able to use the pieces, the stipend and the waiver, strategically, and that was done at the department level, whereby in some instances the stipend was sufficient and they didn't need the waiver to attract the student. In other instances, the waiver was sufficient, the student didn't have a stipend. So departments have been very intentional about how they've been managing that. And we do put a ceiling on the dollars we will waive in our various categories in any given year. Those are managed through the graduate school and then assigned out to the various departments. So we no longer have essentially the blank check, if you will, that if a department can afford, either through grant or through other dollars they have available, if they can afford the stipend, the waiver is automatic. We've chosen to disconnect those. And we found that's worked very effectively for us.
Questions? Told you, Karen, you got the first short straw. Representative Howland.
Sorry, I couldn't let it go. Just to give us an example of, maybe you can verify my example, like your, the flight school program, is that one that would be a negotiated rate with a third party? Like, do you have a lot of students in that? Because when I look at the report, it says international students undergraduate that receive waivers, it says 53. And I know that you must have more than that for students that are that would technically be paying under than the, you know, less than the 267%. So I'm just trying to understand a good example of, you know, where the difference is there in a third party example.
Yep, and I think that's a fair question. In the aerospace example, these would be undergraduate students. There's a percentage of them that would be international students. I'd venture a guess it's probably a couple hundred. So again, they would be charged on their billing the resident rate, and the third party is paying that bill, essentially. So there's no waiver. If it were an average international undergraduate student coming here on their own and there wasn't a third party involvement, that student would be billed the 2 2/3 of the resident rate. And if there were a waiver approved, and again, we've got some programs where that might be a possibility, then it would show up as a waiver. So yes.
Other questions? Yeah, you got up easy, Ellen.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert.
All right. Kirsten. Ms. Dietrich. Sorry.
Thank you.
Bill? Chancellor Goetz?
Sure. We have a couple of other institutions that were prepared at least to make some comments, if that's appropriate. They're available and willing to, so it's your call.
Let's, which institutions?
President Richmond, President Fuller, two.
Committee members?
Mr. Chairman, that's great. I got a lot of questions left.
Yeah?
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, and Chancellor Goetz and other institutions, as you know, there is going to be a performance audit with regard to this issue. And maybe it would be, in the interest of time, simpler to wait until that, because there could be questions that need to be addressed at that time with regard to all of the institutions. I think there was enough interest in our research universities and the differences between those institutions that's the reason they were on the agenda. I think I would prefer to wait for them unless Senator Flackel has a different opinion, Senator Nephi.
Mr. Chairman, I do think that we haven't heard anything about waivers relating to dual credits for high school students, and I think that's to be discussed by the School of Science, and so I'm just...
Dr. Richmond, is that part of your presentation? All right. I'm okay. Committee members, we're going to listen a little longer. And Ms. Dietrich, I guess you will wait a little longer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name's John Richmond, and I proudly serve as the president at North Dakota State College of Science. In the sake of time, in respect to Senator Neffing's specific questions to dual credit, I can cover our waiver situation at NDSCS in general, or I can specifically speak to the dual credit piece in its single slice.
Why don't you do the dual credit piece first?
The waivers we have for dual credit is one of our two highest percentage of waivers that we do at our campus. For dual credit, our dual credit waivers equal 54.5%, or 625 students are in our dual credit program that are waived. We establish this rate based upon a negotiated rate in partnership with the various public school districts that we work with in our dual credit offerings. We offer dual credit basically in the southeast corner of the state. Three primary institutions would be the Fargo Public Schools, West Fargo Public Schools, Jamestown Public Schools, and then the Southeast Regional Educational Association. Those would be our three primary providers of our dual credit. And that rate was negotiated with those districts as we established those agreements. Questions about that?
What's the dollar amount that you referred to? And is it part of the institutional waiver category that's reflected, you know?
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, during your break, I did hand out, I did place at your stations a page and a half of information pertaining to all of our waiver situations. And yes, it is part of our institutional waivers. As I said, it's the highest percentage of our waivers are given in that number in the dual credit area. Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, I know Representative Dosh is probably not going to like this, but it gets complex. Depending upon the delivery method and the faculty member teaching the course would determine our rate. We have some dual credit students that pay full tuition rate. We have other dual credits students that pay a 70% reduced tuition rate, depending upon the delivery method and or the faculty member teaching the specific college course. And that gets real complex. If it's over interactive TV, if it's face-to-face, if it's on our campus, if it's in Jamestown, your question this morning, Mr. Chairman, about who's paying what, in our case, the way we manage that, if it's a high school instructor that we hire that has gone through our screening and application and applied to teach the course and meets our qualifications using our curriculum, if they're already getting paid by the public schools, we aren't going to pay them in addition. We pay them a stipend, not what we would pay a regular adjunct faculty member to teach that same course on our campus. So it varies depending upon who's teaching it, how it's being taught, where it's being taught.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative, or Senator Neffing.
Mr. Chairman and President Richmond, are these courses where most of these 625 students receive the waiver, are they primarily the trade courses as we would think of them, or are they the college entry level, or can you...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nethling, I don't have the specific breakdown by program area. We do offer current technical programs that are in the dual credit area. Architectural drafting, automotive, for example, computer science, those things would fit into the current technical category. A lot of our courses are anatomy, physiology, English, math. Those also make up a good percentage of our courses. So to answer your question, it would be a mix of both. Our intent and our desire would be, as we continue down this path, is to work with school districts to provide more and more of the current technical type programs. But obviously with the space issue, the equipment issues, those become more challenging in the delivery of those types of courses.
Thank you.
Senator Flackel.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Richmond, I'm guessing that I have two questions that are pretty straightforward. Have you been able to track the students so far that have gone through the program? Because I'm guessing this is kind of a gateway strategy from your campus and from the entire university system to essentially get them in the door and get them started in college, in essence. I mean, have you been able to track those students in terms of how many, go on to college within the university system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Flackel, no, we have not been able to do that on our campus at this time. We hope to do that in the future, and I want to be clear why we want to do that, because I get asked that by my staff quite often. What's the benefit of us doing dual credit if they don't become our students, John? As we went into this, my philosophy was this was not, as really any of our efforts, to build our enrollment. This is an effort to make us more accessible to a more diverse population to increase the educational attainment of the North Dakota citizens. Okay? So we have not been able to track that even to our own campus at this point.
And then the last question is it fair to think that your numbers have gone up quite a bit in the last couple of years due to the merit-based scholarship requiring either dual credit or AP courses?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Flackel, yes, we do believe that is happening for that reason.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions. Why wouldn't you pay a high school teacher who teaches on your campus as an adjunct faculty member?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martinson, I maybe wasn't clear the way I described that earlier. If a high school instructor were to come to our campus to teach a course outside of their normal teaching load at the high school, we would pay that individual our normal adjunct rate. My example, what I was trying to explain is in some dual credit courses, we hire the high school instructor that is teaching the course within their building in Jamestown or West Fargo, and they are getting paid by the public school. So we pay the stipend. We pay a stipend. We aren't going to pay them twice to teach the same course once. We're not going to pay them to teach a high school course and to teach our course at the same time. We don't see that the benefit to the taxpayers of North Dakota.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand this, Mr. Chairman. So which course are they teaching for the dual credit, the high school class or the college class?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martins, let me be very clear on that. They are not teaching a high school course. They are teaching our college course as part of their high school load.
So just explain that, Mr. Chairman, a little bit more. So give me an example. So are there kids in that classroom that are both high school kids and kids taking the dual credit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, as was presented yesterday, there are examples of that happening in our operation as well as other places. Yes, that is happening for a good reason, because in some of our smaller districts, in order to be able to offer a viable curriculum, if we did not do that, then the critical mass of students in a course is not great enough to generate the revenue to teach that course. So those students that were taking it as a high school course would not have that course as an option.
So, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I wasn't here for that yesterday, but so basically, some of the, they're getting the same class, and some are high school kids getting high school credit, but and some are college kids getting college credit. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martinson, we don't manage the high school. We don't manage what they grant and don't grant. We teach a college course and assess the students and provide them the grade that they have earned.
Well, I'm sorry I'm taking so much time on this.
Right.
But Mr. Chairman, this dual credit thing has always concerned me. So you're still, okay, you're hiring a high school teacher, but you're not paying them a college adjunct faculty. But you're giving them a stipend because they're a high school teacher, but you're teaching kids who are both in high school and college. I think we should have another meeting on this when we can have some more time, because I've always been concerned that high school kids are, or that we're giving college credit for high school classes.
Let me try to ask it maybe just in a slightly different way. You have a high school teacher teaching a college course to students that are in the room with him or her, or are they online?
Mr. Chairman, in some cases, yes and yes.
Okay. But are they all high school students?
Mr. Chairman, if they are in a high school setting, yes.
Okay.
If they are on our campus, not necessarily.
Okay, so that instructor in West Fargo could conceivably have high school students in the room with him and college students at some remote location taking the same class at the same time? Am I interpreting what you just said correctly?
Mr. Chairman, in some cases with the interactive network, that would be the case.
Okay. Is there any possibility that the high school students that are in the room with him, some of them are taking a high school, getting credit for a high school course, and some of those high school students are getting credit for a college course because they chose to pay the tuition costs?
Mr. Chairman, as long as the curriculum that the college student that's paying the college tuition is meeting the standards of the college curriculum, okay. Yes.
But if all of the students in that room are getting the same course and it meets the college curriculum and everything, and one chooses to pay the college tuition and the other doesn't, they're taking the same exact course. And one's getting college credit because he chose to pay for it in a dual credit way, and the other one's getting high school credit because he chose not to.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding would be correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly.
But I think the president maybe misunderstood or maybe misspoke.
That wouldn't be the first time.
I know. And I don't want to correct you, and I got to look at Amy wants to jump up back there. I can just see it. And she might have to, but I don't think you have a high school teacher teaching the college course to college students through Ivan or anything else. I think when it's the high school teacher teaching the high school dual credit course, that they're only teaching the high school students. But Amy could maybe answer that. She's right behind you.
Let's dance.
Right alongside of you now.
I am back. Okay, let me give you what this scenario most often looks like. If you have a high school teacher in the high school classroom, there are those cases, in fact, where you might have some students taking dual credit and some that aren't. In fact, when I was a high school English teacher, I did this with SDSU through Brookings. I had some in there that were, some in there that weren't. But much like you would handle a high school class where you have different levels of students learning at different levels, a lot of those high school teachers are very adept, as you know, that they would be qualified enough to teach as an adjunct. So they're teaching a college curriculum, but they offer a slightly modified curriculum, typically for the students not enrolled in dual credit. Maybe different assignments, helping them out in those ways, but they still are teaching at that standard of the college curriculum. Now, in the IVN courses, Most of, I have not heard of any time when it's IVN that it, there may be students existing in the classroom watching in the same scenario, but in those classrooms, it's also, when you go into a high school, students don't sit in rooms without somebody in there with them, a facilitator of some kind. And that facilitator will typically work with the high school instructor to offer a modified curriculum to those students that are in there because of numbers that are not the college student. Does that make sense? Have I answered that question well?
But Amy, but is it, but you wouldn't have, I mean, you wouldn't have a high school teacher teaching students on his campus.
High school students? No. A high school teacher would be teaching.
No. Because what he said was there could be through Ivan where the high school teacher was teaching high school students and college students.
Oh, okay. I know what you're saying, Representative Kelch. So in a unique scenario, let me play out what the president was trying to say right there. Let's say we have a night class. We've hired the high school teacher to come onto the NDSCS campus to teach the night class. That night class may be televised over IVN, where it's the high school teacher in the classroom teaching collegiate students, but it might be getting piped in to high school students as well. That they were hired as an adjunct. Okay, so they're a high school instructor by day, highlighting at night as a college instructor. Great way to make some extra income.
I think I agree with Representative Martinson that we will take time for a
I think it would be good.
Thorough explanation so that those of us on the committee that aren't educators can get the opportunity to better understand this situation.
You know, I think that's a great idea because we throw around a ton of educational jargon that doesn't always make sense. So if we could pare that down and make it make sense for everybody, I think that that'd be valuable.
So an executive decision's been made.
I'll be there.
Dr. Richmond, do you have anything further that you would like to deliver to this committee?
I'm going to take a Chairman Scarpa, yeah, I'm going to take one risk here. My business office, Representative Dosh, would love nothing more for me to come home and say that the board has said one charge for everybody. But as I remind our business office, this isn't about what's best for us. This is what we need to do to provide a world-class educational environment that's accessible and affordable, where we can educate and train a workforce for the business and industries of North Dakota. And I don't care how complex that is, we will do whatever that takes in order to meet that demand. And sometimes we have to have different rates. Sometimes we have to have different programs. The example here where you see JD and CAT, that's John Deere and Caterpillar. That was a negotiated agreement that they provide $6.9 million worth of equipment. But to get that, to be able to educate that workforce, we had to come up and agree with one fee. Because the dealer, Dan Butler and CAT has dealerships in North Dakota and South Dakota. Dan doesn't care where a student comes from or where he puts them to work in one of his dealerships in North Dakota or South Dakota. What he cares about is that we provide that world-class education and they come out as an entry-level technician, very knowledgeable and very skillful. That requires a different rate than some other program in some other part of the state. It's a very complex issue. But we will be more than glad to come back and address the dual credit in more detail if you so desire, Mr. Chairman. And with that, any other questions?
I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Fuller. You didn't need to thank Bill for getting you up there. You know.
No, I just told him I was surprised I'm doing this. I didn't think I was going to do it. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for taking time. I'll try to keep this short. I'm not exactly sure where to focus in on other than to emphasize that Minot State University is a regional university. And I think what was driven in our charge to talk about differentials in tuition is basically based on mission and cause and direction. Minot State is a regional institution. We're 40 miles from the Canadian border. We are not on a major interstate. We are clear up in the northwest corner of North Dakota. We are in an area that is very difficult to recruit students to. And when I took over as president 8 years ago, the information we were receiving from many people in this state was that by 2017 there would be 30% fewer high school graduates in 2017. And I was also aware, as I was going around and going and visiting small communities up in with our region, one being Ray, I went to Tioga, I talked to the local high schools, but I remember in Ray in particular, we went there and I was talking to the principal there. He was remarking about the number of students he had graduating from RAID a number of years ago and the fact that it's about a third of what he had had when I was there, and this was in 2005. He also pointed out to me that that number of 30 students that they normally had graduated, the number they had in their elementary class was 4 students in elementary class, and he was scared to death. What I know of my region and going to Drake and all of these smaller communities is these smaller communities were declining, and this state of North Dakota was very much attentive to the need to build people, population, keep people, attract people to this state. That was a driving need for us, and I know that the Roundtable project was really set up to do that type of economic development, but the economic development that was envisioned in the Roundtable was a long way away from what we were facing in Minot. Now, jump up about 8 years from that point. We have had a disastrous flood in Minot. We have an energy industry that has completely turned our community upside down. But going out to Williston to the state board meeting the other day, I could not believe Ray that I had visited and Stanley to see what's happened in those areas. We're still trying to assess what that means for us and for our growth, but we're still not aware of how it's going to be working on us, particularly when you come, and I invite you, if you haven't been to Minot, to drive through Minot right now. It looks like it's been a nuclear holocaust in Minot. South of our campus, we have hundreds and hundreds of houses that are completely empty and abandoned. We've got weeds growing up. It's a terrible situation, and then we have this energy field. The reason I wanted to mention that is that what we're dealing with is a geography that forces all of us to think about different ways of attracting students and remaining viable. I was very surprised to hear from our auditor, and I'm sorry for pointing this out, and I also heard from others here too, about we're not sure why people want more enrollment. People want more enrollment, these schools want enrollment, because we have to remain viable. We have to do that to bring in more tuition. And while, you know, if I were to talk to my faculty about this and mention that Minot State University is a business, they'd have trouble calling us a business, but we are a business. We've got to figure out how do we make the best deal to attract students, to keep our programs viable, and that's not going to happen with one tuition rate. You know, I think we talk about real-world examples. I was glad we talked about the cost of cars, because the cars have all these differential costs. I'd look at hotels. I stayed at a hotel last night. You can get different rates for if you have a AAA rate, or if you're a state institution, you can get a different rate. You can get all kinds of differential costs if you just shop around a lot. And the reason those are there, it's not because they want to make everything consistent. The reason those are there is because they want people to come and stay at their hotel. We want students to come and stay at our university because that's my responsibility, to run an operation that is sound, that is done with principle, that has a lot of ethical principles and support. We are good managers of our campus, and that's the reason we do it. Now, I don't want to raise this because I know you want to get out of here, but one thing I do want to say is that one major initiative, and I've heard the term Minot mentioned about 30 or 40 times in the last 2 days because of our flat rate tuition rate. I'd like to address that right head on, because that flat rate tuition rate is there because that was strategically, we studied that for 3 years, and we understood that based on the competition, based on where we were, based on what pressures we're having, we had to look at a new way to attract students. And that would happen by having Montana, Minnesota, North Dakota, or South Dakota, Nebraska, a lot of regional school people coming to our institution, as well as international students. We called our flat rate tuition rate Grow North Dakota because it was basically set up to grow North Dakota. That was our obligation, to attract students around in other states, from international to our community, because we know from our experience that we have nearly 30% of the people who come to our institution from out of state who stay here. And they also, and I've got a lot of details, and I'd love to share it with you, but I have to cut this a little short, but our analysis of the financing of that shows that our Grow North Dakota project does attract students, and it also is very financially productive. And the state, based upon our analysis, puts in about $5,600 per student based upon the numbers of students we have in here. This particular project, when we brought in 152 additional students with the Grow North Dakota program, would actually realize $16,000 per student. In effect, it was a great way to initiate and gain more funds for our campus. Funds, students, and also the potential for them to stay here in our state. That was what was back of it. There's no other reason than that. We had to remain competitive, and it's worked. And so with that, I've got all kinds of other information to talk about reasons people want waivers. I can only tell you that as NDSU had pointed out and UND had pointed out, we do compete on a national global level. We compete for faculty on that level. We compete for students on that level. We seek students to come here on that in that regard. We've got to be competitive and seek those students to make our programs viable. So. And then also faculty and staff. We've got to make sure we retain faculty and staff. And many of the waivers you see on that list, that very long, confusing list that you were talking about, are really focused on supporting people through a mandate, but also supporting people who need help, like Native Americans who need support to come to school, and others do. So anyway, it does appear complex on the outside. And I must admit, I was somewhat confused by hearing all these other ways that people do it at other institutions. I really don't care about those institutions, frankly. I care about my institution. I want to keep it viable and strong. And I think our funding model and the way we are looking to the future addresses that. So,
Dr. Fuller, I thank you. I did forget something that's very important here, and that is someone has to leave at about 4 o'clock. That needs to have an opportunity to speak. And you will get an opportunity, I'm sure, to address the committee again after the report that we probably have with regard to tuition waivers later from the performance audit. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just add one quick point. If there are any people that want more details on that Grow North Dakota plan, the financing of it, the reasons for it, how it works, how it has worked before Grow North Dakota and after, I would love to explain it. So please call me if you have any questions. But thanks for your attention. Appreciate you getting me on.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Diedrich, I apologize for my senior moments that I seem to have all too frequently.
That's not a problem. If I'm out of here at 4 o'clock, I'll be okay.
If I have to pay a fine, I have to pay a fine.
Oh, my husband will serve all those kids dinner. I'll get there. Boy, I'm very excited by what happened here today. I think this is what we needed, and I'm hoping that this would alleviate the issues we've had lately. It's almost like we're pitting the schools against each other as to who's giving out more waivers, and I think what you've heard today is that they're all doing it for the right reason. They're all following policy. They might just do it differently. And if there's more that we need to do about this, I guess we'll hear from you on that. But was it sufficient? Did we change anybody's mind today? Representative Dosh?
Quit picking on Representative.
Yes, really. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dosh.
No, you have. And first, just a comment quickly from Dr. Fuller. I'm really glad you view Minot State as a business entity. I love to hear that because it means that you're looking at your income and your expenses and you're trying to be a viable institution. So really do appreciate that. I wish everyone, I think oftentimes we hear of education, it's like, well, you know, you can't quantify it, you can't really put value to it or this or that. And I think they are businesses. I think every college and university, has to be a viable out there because, I mean, either if they're not, the taxpayer shouldn't be supporting them. So I appreciate your comments on that. And as far as business waivers go, today was very helpful because we as legislators have to explain this. And, you know, I think you have to admit that when everyone is different out there and when we can't really explain it, because everything is different, nothing is the same, it is very difficult. But I think today gave us, or at least myself, a better understanding of how we handle waivers. I don't necessarily maybe agree on some of the issues, but I think it gives us a better understanding of what's happening out there, and we never, don't want to pit one institution against the other, but we're trying to understand it. Why does NDSU have more waivers than UND or some of these others? And I just think it's important, and I've really enjoyed today, and I want to thank Higher Ed and the Auditor's Office and bringing these to light and talking about it and discussing it, and gives us a little bit more basis to go off of, so thanks.
That's wonderful. I'm happy to hear you respond that way because I have been working on mainly the fees but also looking into the tuition waivers for a couple of months now, and I still am confused as to who's doing what and how they report it, but when it all comes out in the end, they're all following policy and they're doing what's the best for their universities and our students. And so I think it's a good thing, which is my segue into the fee task force. We've had three meetings looking at the fees, and that's another situation where everybody is doing it a little differently. And at our last meeting, we had the pleasure of Representative Dosh and Representative Scarpole sitting in and talking with us about some of the concerns that the legislators have about the fee issue, and I was very pleased because their concerns were our concerns, and the three main ones were the transparency and the accountability issues, and also how do we even define things when they're saying if it's a certain type of a fee, one school uses one term, one uses another. And so what the committee came up with is that right now, until we get our new chancellor in place, we're going to kind of table everything until Dr. Shirvani comes in with his plans. However, we did gain an awful lot of knowledge on, the different ways that the institutions are, proposing their fees, or how they decide, do the students have a voice in whether or not they increase a fee or they add a fee, which kind of leads to possibly making that a system-wide, it's not a policy, but having a system-wide approach as to how we classify fees, how they're placed on the website, what the student input is going to be, without damaging the schools to the point where they feel locked in, but at least have it defined to the point where whenever you look at something and you see college fee, you know what a college fee covers. Okay. The one point that we haven't addressed, and I don't believe that we even have a policy for, is the accountability piece. I haven't seen anything where we have system in place where we can go in and see that those fees were used for that student, and that is something that I've discussed with Dr. Shirvani, and he has some ideas on that, and so we're going to wait for that. But if you had any other questions with regard to the fees, I'd like to answer them if I can.
Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think more importantly, what from the discussion, from the message that I got this morning from our discussion, was that there needs to be an accountability. Now, I understand that there are some of the fees that, you know, the institutions need to have that flexibility. But if the fees say that they're going to the wellness center, then there should be a tracking or an accountability to show us, and it, you know, be a line item, be something that says, yes, that money went to the wellness center. Or, you know, when it's specifically designated that way, I think for our comfort level, you know, fees are going to be fees, or and we know that they're going to be charged. But, you know, I think when you really have that specific line item, we need to see the accountability. We need to see the tracking that, yes, that money is actually going there. So if we saw that, I think that a lot of us would have a greater peace of mind about the fees. And when I say, you know, to be careful about locking down, you know, some of the fees, you know, I know that there needs to be some flexibility perhaps in some of the student activity fees or some of those things, but when it specifically says this is what that fee is for, I want to see that that's where that money is going to.
If, and Representative Kelsch, that is exactly what Dr. Chobani was talking about, is having some type of a matrix that would go to the institutions every year. Now, I don't want to speak for him, but this was just casual conversation. Having something where they just actually write in and they report where these monies went, okay, how much revenue they received and where the revenue was spent. So I agree with you.
In the interest of, you know, being accountable, I think something could be done to the effect, and I understand the need for flexibility, but we require a fiscal irregularities report with regard to employees that, you know, receive something unusual. And I think that, you know, as Representative Kelch said, we don't lock it down, but if that money does need to be used by the institution for some other purpose, they should report it to someone. You know, that's a very simple thing to do, I think, in my mind, and I'm not sure that we'd be unreasonable about it. I just think that being made aware of it actually enables a higher level of trust. So, other questions of Ms. Dietrich? Senator Flackel.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dietrich, are you, what kind of feedback are you hearing based upon the legislation sponsored last session by, I believe it was Senator Schneider, I was on there, a couple others, with respect to the transparency part of the fees? Have you had much of that that's came to your committee, or just in casual conversations or emails from anyone?
Could you give me a little, what was in the document? Which one is it? Okay, so it was on the website?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we have had some discussion about the website, and I've talked with Randall somewhat about what our options are, and it's working very well, you know, the prototype that they have out there, but we'd like to add a section in there so when the students are, you know, looking at a fee, and if one institution just calls it a university fee, they could click on that, and it would bring them to the definition within the website so they could see what the definition is and what those fees cover. That would be one way that we would work on the transparency through that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, it's good information, but have you got really any feedback, or is not really?
I haven't, no. That should have been a yes or no answer.
Further questions? When you asked a question of whether or not you changed anybody's minds, hopefully you meant for the better.
Yes, I did. I'll be more careful in how I make my statements.
It's that mean little inner child again.
That is.
Any other questions for Ms. Dietrich? If not, thank you, and okay. Drive safe.
Yep, thank you.
What's left? Comments by other persons. Mr. Rayford, would you mind sitting down for just a minute, because there were some things that you said that intrigued me just a little bit, and I again have to point out my lack of knowledge. But you talked about competing for graduate students. Give us some idea what that means. In other words, if you would, and I understand you've been at NDSU a relatively short time, but I think you have a pretty fair understanding of what I'm trying to get to, and that is that in today's environment, if NDSU, you know, Give me an idea what you mean by compete. Do you, how many applicants do you get? How do you seek out applicants you don't get? In a relatively short period of time, give me as briefly as possible and as succinctly as possible, give me some kind of an idea, please.
I'll do the best I can. It begins with a marketing strategy that is built around your core brand, your programs that have strength. There'll be regional differences. There'll be differences on the field. So the way you would market and try to pursue MBAs would be different than PhDs in physics, than in food science or entomology. So I mean, there's, you know, different markets, but I think it starts with the core brand and the marketing. There's a number of strategies that can be used to find the world's best students. And so there would be strategies that would be appropriate in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. There's a lot of direct contact. Direct mail has passed into market history. More and more it's become all about the web. Having a good page rank and having a good search engine optimization on your website is just absolutely essential now. I mean, today's students are very technologically and social networking enabled. You know, the tools that they're using are unfamiliar, really, with a lot of the tools that our faculty grew up with 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you can't recruit a student who doesn't know you exist. So we need to bring a sense of awareness to this, whatever population we're trying to get to apply. And then students will apply. NDSU typically has maybe about 3,000 students apply for graduate studies, and we'll admit about half those. I'm not that familiar yet with our undergraduate numbers because that's actually Prakash Matthew in the registrar's office, and undergraduate admissions are in his area, not in mine.
So you typically get, you think at least, two applicants for every opening?
Oh, yes. And I think there's a possibility there of, as we get the word out to a bigger audience, of, you know, building the applicant pool. You know, ultimately, it comes down to many of the students who apply to NDSU or UND will apply elsewhere as well. And I'm thinking particularly now about, you know, students who have graduated with a bachelor's degree in North Dakota. And, you know, so they will have a credential, they'll have a desire to go, or a high school degree, they'll have a desire to take their high school degree and their academic market value and go to the best college that they can. And likewise, if they're graduating with a bachelor's degree, to find the best graduate school they can. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to compensation package and the finances. You know, each undergraduate student is seeking to minimize the reliance upon loans. You know, many of the parents find affording tuition difficult. So, you know, there is a financial dimension, and particularly for the students who have excelled academically.
So on the flip side, let me go to the flip side, because I'm going to guess you understand that too, and that is that if I'm a graduate student wanting a position, what's the likelihood I get offers from multiple places?
Your comment is prescient. It would have been the next words out of my mouth. That's really the essence of competing, that the people who would like to have come here will have offers at two or three or four other places as well. So a student that we accept into NDSU and we'd like to come is probably also accepted into Virginia Tech or University of Iowa or maybe my alma mater, University of Florida. And now that student will make a decision based on the strength of our program, the faculty that are available for them to work with. And since you spoke to graduate students, really the financial aspects, many of those students will have family, and perhaps one or two children, and so they have an obligation to provide for their family. So these are real issues. What are the health insurance benefits, which is a topic we haven't yet touched on as well.
And the reason I'm pursuing this a little bit is because of the fact that sometimes as North Dakotans we feel undeserving. We think we don't measure up to what other places do. And I guess I'm getting of the opinion that we shouldn't have that attitude about our research universities. And I'm wondering if...
Absolutely not.
We really are giving away something we don't need to be giving away. And I'm wondering if there is any type of analysis being done that would have enough credibility to make our flagship institutions consider being less generous with waivers and so forth. Because when I look at this document, UND's got 585 graduate students for $3.1 million. NDSU has more than twice as many, but they spend more than twice as much to get them. And I'm just, you know, I'm not being critical or anything. I'm just saying, I'm wondering if what's happened at our flagship institutions have brought us to the point where we need to be prouder of what we have and less need to be as generous as we are.
I couldn't agree more on the fact that we really have something special here at the flagships in North Dakota. I suppose you would expect me to say that since I moved here, but I think that really is the reason. I moved from a place I loved to come here to North Dakota because of the just the factors you've laid out. I do think that an earlier comment about reframing this discussion on the revenue side would really be a valuable next step. That we do have the investment made in higher ed in North Dakota. We do have these assets and these faculty at our disposal. It might be better to measure year-to-year increases in revenue. How are we doing in terms of getting more students from around the country, keeping the students from around state, coming here, then I think, you know, I now, in the 9 months I've been here, finally appreciate that there are difficulties in comparing the waived amounts from one institution to another for no other reason on this 267 versus 150 versus 100 type thing, that it may actually be the same product that is showing up with radically different reporting on waivers just based on the differences across the system on tuition structure. But I think really on the revenue side of the equation, that's a source of support for our universities that doesn't have to come from the legislature or from the taxpayer.
Are you aware of any substantial effort being done with regard to the results of graduate programs? In other words, what I'm getting at is that would indicate what the likely income is of a master's from NDSU or a doctorate. I mean, is there good quantitative information? And if that indicator would be such that the value of your doctoral degree from NDSU is worth more than the one from Iowa, would that not be also a factor in a graduate student considering where to go?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is, as you might expect, an enormous amount of literature on this topic. I've not seen any, however, that disaggregates down to state level. So they tend to really look more at PhD versus master's versus bachelor's versus associates, and only recently has the literature started disaggregating by field. And the fields are still very broad. They're nowhere near the CIP code or the IPED's level of resolution. But now people can see that there is a big difference in terms of, say, a master's over a bachelor's if you're talking business versus social science or biology or agriculture. I think those types of numbers are known. What's not known is really the value add or the economic development value add one state to the other.
Mr. Thursby.
Yes. Brilliant.
No, Mr. Thursby, do you have any type of capability with regard to providing that link that you and I have talked about between the graduate positions and salaries that they receive upon graduation for the doctoral programs, the master's programs, and such?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have that directly. The only way we can do that is by matching and having the analysis with the job services data back to our graduates.
And that's only available for North Dakota? You cannot retrieve that from other states?
That is correct.
Yeah, there'd be no way to link to other states? Okay.
No easy way.
Any other questions of Bruce? Senator Nethy.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the provost just one question. How, in your recruitment of your graduate students, as you have discussed, how important is a strong EPSCoR effort in relationship to your recruitment?
I think for those of us, I mean, for EPSCoR states, no EPSCoR state does a better job than North Dakota in EPSCoR. So I've been in several EPSCoR states, and it's just really impressive what's done here. That clearly drives the research side of the equation in a significant way. And that in turn provides the brand as a Carnegie very high. And that has enormous value in terms of finding student awareness, undergraduate level as well as the graduate level.
Chairman, I think our EPSCoR is probably one of our better kept secrets. Even particularly among legislators, we probably don't do enough to, but I'm glad to hear that response, because I often kind of wondered myself. I think those of us that are close to it see to that.
I think it would be good to have the EPSCoR directors, you know, be asked to, you know, give them some time as well. But it is, to my early observations, an extremely strategically run program.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make a comment and thank you for your explanation to my earlier question about why do you give the waiver and why not just pay the GTAs or the GRAs and take care of it in that manner. And your explanation in about 5 minutes put me at a lot more ease, because that wiped out half of your waivers in my mind. Is you have to do it the way you're doing it.
Absolutely.
And you did a great job between you and Alice. You know, that just wipes out half of our questions, I think, or the questions I had on the waivers. So thanks for doing that and explaining it the way you did. It was very helpful to me.
Well, thank you, Representative Munson. Alice and I are spending a great deal of time on the telephone now, and we serve on a task force together as well.
Any other questions, Mr. Rayford? Senator Flack?
I'm not sure. I don't know if this is really a question, but you can respond after I'm done. But, I mean, I think part of what you're talking about doing with the flagships is also to deepen the pool of applicants, as it would appear. And, I mean, I think, you know, a good analogy for me to think about anyway is that it's the recruitment of quality academic graduate students is not unlike the recruitment of student athletes.
Absolutely.
In that quality of place plays into it. You know, what financially burden will I be able to shift? The quality of faculty comparable to the quality of your coach. If you have a John Wooden, what a great recruitment tool. If you have a Nobel Prize recipient, you know, similarly. But I, you know, some of those things all play into a person's decision to, you know, who you may wish to go after, because you know, you're trying to get into that position where you can really be even more selective. And again, I preface it by saying it wasn't really a question, but.
You're right.
Agree.
Care to comment?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that, Senator Flackhall. And again, although I've just been here in the state a brief period of time, I find my thoughts more and more turning to you know, where do the National Merit Finalists, the high-scoring ACT students from our state, the valedictorians from high schools in North Dakota, where, how many of those students depart high school and stay here in the state of North Dakota? How many of those students are we seeing go to other institutions outside of North Dakota? So I haven't had a chance to explore that yet, but that's something that I'm afraid that the answer may not be as many stay here as we would have hoped.
Anything else for you?
Mr. Chairman, more now though, since we have the academic scholarships that get offered to go to North Dakota universities. So that does help.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you again. Appreciate the opportunity.
We still have an unanswered question that needs to get answered today. I'm going to take, oh, Yes, comments from the public.
Good afternoon, Mr., I guess good early evening, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, I'm Shane Gerbert. I'm with UND Student Government and registered lobbyist. I was listening in on these proceedings, and I wanted to talk to an earlier point that was made, brought up actually by Representative Kelch. It's the idea of accountability and knowing where our fees go. And I've talked with a lot of our students, both at UND and with the North Dakota Student Association, which encompasses all of the universities here in the public universities. And I could just put it simply as that we agree. The age-old question of where, how our fees are assessed, and most importantly, where they go, and what we're paying for, is something probably goes back just as long as fees do. And I think this is a perfect time to bring up this point for conversation, because it seems like today we've achieved that perfect triad of having the students, the state board, and even members of the legislature on the same page, in the same book.
Don't sound so surprised.
In the same book about it. And I just wanted to bring that up as a point that if you need any sort of assistance in understanding the student's point of view on this and getting how we want our fees to be assessed and we want to know, I'll be more than happy to get anyone from UND or from the North Dakota Student Association mobilized so that your questions could be answered. And again, I want to say thank you for listening to my remarks. I will stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? I think not.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Any directives for staff? If not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wonder, did you have an EBSCOR as one of your tentative...
We can certainly, make it a topic for discussion at a future meeting.
I think in view of all the things that we've heard the last 2 days and all, that might be something real good, particularly... I'm prejudiced. I got to admit that, but I think they're doing a great job, and I think it helps offer another aspect to what's part of all the things we're doing.
And I would ask the staff: you were trying to get in contact with Tennessee. Did you have any success?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have been working with Marcia Krotzing in the University System Office, and we were not able to get a hold of representatives of the Tennessee Higher Education Commission today, but we will work together to try to contact somebody there.
Representative Kelch?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My dear friend is the director, so I can certainly help you with that outreach.
And committee members, we had hoped to have them here in May. And if that's not possible, we'll see what we can do with regard to that June meeting that was kind of set out in case we need it. So in the event one won't work, we'll try to do the other. And we would intend to have that as a joint type meeting where the board would be able to ask questions as well. Representative Howland.
Just a quick question. The next meeting is a one-day meeting in May?
One-day meeting the 15th.
Okay, and then a comment, if I may.
Yes.
In regard to Representative Martinson's comments about the underfunded institution, I think that our discussions today were more along the lines of tuition and waivers, obviously, but their argument on the was on the underfunded side is on the appropriations, and on, if you look at it on a per-student basis, that's where they're saying that they're amongst the institution, they're not equally. And so that's just where they're coming from on that. I'm not defending
it. Representative Heilman, I realize that you're young, but you should never wake a sleeping giant at the end of a meeting. Anything else for directives for staff? If not, we are adjourned. Thanks, everyone.